is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Nimitz at War, command leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. It's a pleasure to welcome Professor Craig Simons, emeritus professor from the U.S. Naval Academy, writing of a Manchester Nimitz who was principal in the Pacific War of 1941 to 1945. The story is told from the point of view of command leadership, hence the subtitle. This is the story as I've never read it before, not concentrating on the battles, the moments to moments of the drama, the disappointments and the grief, but on the relationships of the flag officers and their equivalent in the U.S. Army. Professor, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. It is Christmas, 1941. Chester Nimitz arrives in Pearl Harbor. What is his mission at that moment? How does he imagine he will proceed, given that the harbor is still burning? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it a lot. We can imagine Chester Nimitz arriving by seaplane in the harbor at Pearl Harbor while the hulls of destroyed battleships are still visible, while small boats are still retrieving American bodies from the water. He has come without a staff, by himself, to take over a wrecked command, and his initial responsibility is to bring about some kind of stability, some kind of sense of the possibility of recovering from this disaster. So I think that's his first thought and his first job.
He's been sent there by Ernest J. King and by Secretary of the Navy Knox and the President of the United States, who tapped him for this job. What is it that they told Admiral Nimitz, and why did they choose him? Do we have an understanding of their thinking?
We have some. You know that Franklin Roosevelt always thought of himself as a Navy man. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War under Woodrow Wilson, and he kept his finger on the pulse of the Navy all the time that he was president. In fact, if I can tell a quick story, he was once handed a list of those suggested for promotion to flag rank, and he was running his finger down the list, and he came to a name and said, "What is this? I don't even know this man." Now, that suggests a lot about the fact that he expected to know personally the flag officers of the Navy, and he did know Nimitz personally, because Nimitz had spent the previous two terms as the bureau chief of what was called the Bureau of Navigation, but was really the Bureau of Naval Personnel. And in that role, he and the president interacted with one another on a pretty regular basis. So FDR knew Nimitz.
Ernest J. King, Comanche, the commander of all the Navy in the Atlantic and the Pacific, a towering personality. Why did he choose Nimitz?
Well, King really had less to do with the selection of Nimitz than I think Roosevelt and Knox did. King knew Nimitz, of course, but King was a bit skeptical of Nimitz. King was a hard-driving, jaw-clenched, let's-get-it-done, no-nonsense kind of commander. And Nimitz was, of course, more of a let's understand each other, let's get along, let me listen to you, we'll reach an accommodation. Their personalities did not match. So King was a little bit uncertain that Nimitz had the toughness to get the job done in the Pacific. But FDR and Knox overruled him.
I learned from the professor that 16 times Chester Nimitz and Ernest King met, mostly in San Francisco, to talk about their accomplishments and differences. And each time I winced when Chester Nimitz was obliged to fly home to San Francisco, knowing he was facing Admiral King. We arrive in Pearl Harbor with everything in a topsy-turvy, and Nimitz must solve leadership. The plot of the professor's book is how these men reacted to each other in this existential moment. And there are ironies here. One is the man who was in charge of Pearl Harbor, the Pacific Fleet at the time, Admiral Kimmel, has now been relieved of duty. But I learned from you, Professor, the irony that that could have been Chester Nimitz who was relieved of duty.
Oh, it's quite possible. In fact, a year before, Franklin Roosevelt had intended to nominate Chester Nimitz to command the Pacific Fleet. And Nimitz, who was junior to 50 more senior admirals knew that there would be resentment in the fleet. It would not be a good idea for him, as junior as he was, to take over such a prestigious position, and suggested that another more senior officer should have the job. And that, of course, turned out to be Kimmel. So that if Roosevelt had insisted and appointed Nimitz to that command in 1940, it would have been Nimitz and not Kimmel who was victimized by the Japanese attack.
Admiral Nimitz sets his headquarters up at near the submarine headquarters. He's a submariner. He thinks of submarines as an offensive weapon, and he will use them accordingly over these next few years. But I got the sense, Professor, that he was thinking, this is an overwhelming task, and I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I've got to get to work right away. And that's a revelatory part of his personality. I would even use the word humble. Is that inappropriate for Chester Nimitz?
No, I think that's fair. But keep in mind, he never told anyone at his command that he was worried or concerned or that he wouldn't last very long. He confided that to his wife in private letters. As far as anybody at Pearl Harbor saw, he was a confident, calm, assured commander who went from person to person, looking them in the eye, shaking their hand, listening to what they had to say. And he brought with him a sense that we can get this done after all. So that lack of certainty that's revealed in his private letters to his wife, he never let that show in his professional job.
Admiral King thinks of him as a fixer. What did that mean? Fixer.
I think King thought of Nimitz as essentially a manager of things. He sat at a desk. He moved papers from the in basket to the out basket. He could deal with personalities. He could solve problems. But he didn't think of him as a Patton or Halsey type, let's go get him, commander. And you see that in these prodding radio messages that King sends to him almost every day. Let's get going. Let's do something. But I think King changes his mind about Nimitz over time.
There is a rivalry in the U.S. Navy at the time that is rendered in terms of shoe wear, the brown shoes versus the black shoes. What did that mean, Professor?
Yeah, when aviation first became part of the Navy hierarchy in the late 1920s, the aviators had different uniforms than the ship drivers, if we can use that term. They wore forest green uniforms with brown shoes. So the regular Navy officers called them brown shoe officers, and the aviators called the ship drivers black shoe officers. And they got along for the most part, but there was a sense of rivalry, without a doubt, between the two branches of the service.
I'm speaking with Professor Craig Simons, Emeritus Professor of History from the U.S. Naval Academy. And we're speaking of Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Chester Nimitz is now in charge of changing the story from defeat, the Japanese wave after wave of success in these first weeks. Remember, the Philippines is under attack at the same time Chester Nimitz arrives. And we're going to switch to the offense when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.